This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Hello, everybody. This is episode 77 of the Intercooler Podcast. I'm Dan Prosser. On the other end of the Zoom call, Andrew Frankel. Hello, Andrew. Good. So we've got plenty to talk about in this episode of the podcast, mostly because a couple of weeks ago, you and I had a poke around a really quite special car collection. So we're going to talk a little bit about that car collection. We're going to sort of share what we can about it and talk about car collections generally. Before we do, though, I mean, we must talk about the Michael Schumacher documentary on Netflix. Schumacher, it's called. Criminally, I haven't watched it yet. I haven't had time. But it came out only a few days ago. Shocking, I know. It came out a few days ago, and it's had a load of press, hasn't it? There's loads of people talking about it. I'm just curious to know what you thought of it.
Well, I was, if you read the Instagram, so I wrote a piece on it saying that basically I was nervous about it because I think that families and, you know, make no mistake, this is a production by the Schumacher family. There may be a different production company, a lot of professional people made it, but it was made so much in conjunction with them. It's very much their view. And I just think that families are the worst people to make those sort of programs because how, you know, if somebody wanted, not that they ever would, but somebody wanted to make a documentary about my family and were asking me about it, I'd say they're all wonderful because that's how I see them. That's not how the world necessarily sees anybody. So I was, having been a bit disappointed by the Senna documentary, and I know I'm in a very, very small minority about that, but that was just a love letter to Ayrton. And as, you know, I don't think there are many bigger Ayrton Senna fans than me, but I just wanted to see a fully rounded picture. I wanted to get the full idea of this man in with all the light and shade and everything else, and I felt I never got that in the Senna documentary. And I just thought, well, there's no chance of getting that in the Schumacher documentary. And yet, there it is. That's the amazing thing. It's very much a, you know, it is a fond reflection on the man's professional life and his personal life. I don't imagine that anybody, even if you really, really felt you had good cause to, would want to put the boot into Michael, particularly given, you know, his sad current situation. But there's no attempt to whitewash it. You know, they don't skirt past the Damon incident in 94 or the Jacques incident in 97. You know, and you know, there are fascinating bits in it. There, you know, there's Jean Todt saying that in 1999, after Schumacher had been there four seasons at the end of the 1999 season and had not delivered a Drivers' World Championship, you know, Todt was saying, I was thinking, have we hired the wrong bloke? Should we not actually have Mika Häkkinen driving for us? And that's all on there. There's Ross Brawn talking about the Jacques incident and saying, at the time he did it, because of the sort of person that he is, Michael would have been absolutely sure that he did nothing wrong. And so it wasn't like he thought, well, this is terrible, but I'm going to do it anyway. At that moment, what he thought he was doing was correct. And then Ross was saying that only on reflection, when he saw the video and everything else, would he realise that actually what he did was indefensible. And it was, it was a fantastic insight into the man. But B, it was actually, you know, even for someone like Ross, and everybody knows how close Ross and Michael were, it was quite critical of his character and the way that he conducted himself in specific instances. So it's not this, you know, blind, you know, rose-tinted spectacles view of the man. And it's all the better for it. The other thing that is great about it is it's so well-paced. So, you know, I thought, oh, goodness, so we're going to go through, you know, once he got to Ferrari, we're going to go through the 2000 championship and the 2001, and the 2002, 2003, 2004, and so all this, which are frankly really, really boring years for motor racing because he just won everything. And I thought, oh, God, we're going to have all Mercedes years as well because, you know, that's his most recent. And there's none of it. You know, there's so much on, you know, that first race at Spa with Jordan, 91, and then all the Benetton years. So building up, building up, building up. And then that critical moment in 94 when, you know, some would say he took out Damon and denied Damon the championship. And then, you know, soon after that, you're into Ferrari. And the story of how he worked with the others to help transform Ferrari, that's really fascinating. And, you know, and all the real crowd-pleaser stuff like Spain 96 is in there. And then you get to 2000, which is his first championship year with Ferrari. And that's gone into, and the various battles he had there. And then you think, hang on, there's only like 30, it's an hour, I think it's nearly 2 hours, and there's like only 13 minutes left. And you think, well, how are they going to deal with it? And they just don't, because they understand, like we understand, that it's not that interesting. And I think the other thing about it, which I really appreciated, was, you know, they couldn't ignore what happens at the end. You know, you watch the entire film, and although it is a, you know, it's a very interesting and insightful view, particularly on the personal side with, you know, with his children and him growing up and so on and so forth, you know that this event is coming. And when you get to it, there are some, you know, they reveal nothing about his current condition in specific terms. But you do have Mick saying he'd give it all up just to be able to talk about his shared love of motorsport with his father. So clearly he can't do that. And you've got Coroner, his wife, saying she'd give it all up just to have him back. And then saying, although, of course, he's still here. And so, you know, you don't need, you know, a doctor to give a bulletin to know that it's, you know, it's terrible. It must be. And apparently, and I haven't seen any of this because, you know, I don't sort of read the sort of papers that would say so. But apparently, the documentary has received some criticism for not delving deeper into that particular incident and the results of it and everything else. And, you know, I do understand it, I'm afraid. But what's that phrase? Just because it interests the public doesn't make it in the public interest. And, you know, I think they do really, really well. And I think they provide enough not to sort of, you know, ignore it. And it's personal and it's poignant and it's very sad. I thought it was a beautiful documentary. I thought so much better than the Senna film. And so unexpectedly so. Yeah. I was fascinated by it. I was moved by it. It didn't annoy me at all. The problem with people like you and me is because, just because of what we do, we know a bit. The capacity for these programs to annoy people like you and me because you think, well, he's talking rubbish and that didn't happen the way they said it. It's just none of that. It's all quite straightforward. And also the other thing about it is you don't have, you know, motoring journalists waffling on relentlessly. What you do have, all the talking heads are there. Almost everybody that, you know, from Bernie to Damon, everybody, Flav's on, everybody is, whether you like them or not, all the important people are there, with the exception, I would say, of Brundle's not on it, which I think is an omission, and Jacques Villeneuve's not on it, but I think we probably know what his point of view would have been. Lovely. Great documentary. If you're thinking about, you know, taking out a Netflix trial, do it for that. And I'm not being paid by Netflix to say it. I think it's just a great piece of work.
Well, brilliant. I will go and watch it this week. It's almost an impossible, unwinnable task, isn't it, for the producers of something like that? Because there will be diehard motorsport enthusiasts who want more detail, broader coverage of his career, early career, the other stuff that he did. But then it also, you know, if you only produce a show, a film for those people, yeah, you know, a few thousand will watch it. It needs to reach a big audience. So,
but they do have some of that stuff in there. You know, there's bits at the beginning. You know, there's quite a bit of his karting career in there, and about how they used to go and nick ruined tyres. People used to take the tyres off their carts and chuck them in the bin, and he'd go and fish them out of the bin, stick them on his cart, and go and win. He was, you know, the other thing you didn't really appreciate is, you know, you'd sort of think that, you know, like everybody coming up, or almost everybody, he only did it with Hughes backing. He didn't at all. He was skint. They lived hand to mouth. And, you know, I think that's probably where he got his work ethic from. And there's more than enough of that early stuff there to hopefully satisfy the people you're talking about. It's great.
God, I mean, we could just talk about him for so long. It's amazing to me that someone can win a couple of world championships with that sort of background, earn, you know, some eight-figure sum over their early career, probably, and still have that drive and determination to keep going, win five more titles. I mean, it's a rare individual who has that kind of resolve and determination within them.
And you know, you are so right. And, you know, I often think, and I know that Lewis has had a couple of seats, was with some teams where, you know, they weren't front-running teams. But for Michael, in 95, having basically just walked the championship, to think, right, well, done that, and, you know, fine, but, you know, doing the same again doesn't interest me. I'm going to go to a championship, a team which is absolutely on its knees, and see if we can turn it around. And, you know, those 4 years, he went titleless because he was struggling to, you know, not just, you know, get Ferrari to build a faster car, but to overcome all the, you know, the bureaucracy and the weird ways that, you know, the Italians did things back then. And I admire him all the more for it, because if he hadn't done that, because he obviously could have gone to any team he liked, you know, he could have been the first person to get 10 world titles, or, you know, he could have done it easily, but he didn't. He chose not to. He chose to do the harder thing, and I admire him all the more for it.
Great. Well, there you go. I mean, it does sound like you all need to go and watch it if you haven't already. It now seems a bit bloody trivial going off and talking about car collections after that, but that's the nature of the Intercooler podcast, I suppose, so we're going to do it anyway.
Well, I've got tea all over my laptop there.
Okay, well, so, I mean, we did have a fairly extraordinary day, you and I, a couple of weeks ago, didn't we?
Yes, it was quite extraordinary.
There's a chap who's a friend of ours who's got just an extraordinary collection. We're not going to say who it is or where the collection is or give away too many details, purely because he's asked us not to. And we're going to respect his, you know, his request for privacy. And if you happen to know who we're talking about, please do the same.
Please don't say so.
Yeah. And he was...
Apart from anything else, if you do, we may not be allowed out in anything else again. So,
yeah, we want to go back.
Yeah, but it's just, you know, I would hate for the trust that has been placed in us and the privilege of being able to drive this stuff to be repaid by betraying his confidence. So we're not going to do it.
Yeah, that's right. And his generosity as well. I mean, he opened the collection up to us, and almost the first thing he said was, pick a couple of cars and we'll take them out, which is just an extraordinary thing to hear.
It wasn't even I've got a couple of amazing cars for you guys to drive. It was just like we were standing there and they went, well, that one or that one. And, well, we chose, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. And so, I mean, we're going to talk about a handful of the cars that we were, that we took out. We're not going to tell you everything that's in there because, I mean, that's all part of the sort of mystery and the intrigue of a collection like that. They like to keep it quiet so that they can surprise people. But, I mean, it's, you wouldn't, from the side of the road, you would not know it was there at all. It's a sort of subterranean garage. It's enormous. And you walk down the steps and see just these most incredible cars from all different eras. But and they're, in theory, they're all on the key, aren't they? I mean, with older stuff, it's not necessarily that straightforward. But in theory, they're all ready to go.
Well, I mean, I think the fact, and we've talked about drip trays on this podcast before. Every single car has got a drip tray underneath it, which means, you know, there's oil in the engine, and you know, and also, you know, they're all on trickle chargers, and you know, that says to me, you know, cars are on the button. And the fact that we were able just to go, well, we'll take that one and, you know, and fire them up and off we go. You know, says it all, really. And I think it's very interesting because I know obviously we're talking about collection because that is technically what it is. But the owner doesn't talk about a collection at all, because I think when you think about a collection, you think about, frankly, a bunch of museum pieces, cars just sitting there with a light sort of light covering of dust, slightly flat tires, and you know, haven't been driven for 40 years. That's not this at all. They are all good to go, and they're all used. That's the thing; they all get used. Some of them are worth, well, all of them are incredibly valuable cars, but some of them are worth astronomical quantities of money. And I just so admire people who just think to themselves, well, yes, I know it's a risk and it is a bit of a leap, but what's the alternative? The alternative is to reduce them to being something to look at. If you buy a bit of art, stick it on your wall, that's fine because that's what it's designed to do. Its job is to be looked at. It's not a car's job. A car's job is to be driven. And they get that. Luckily for us. So we did.
I mean, there are some very, very significant cars in there. Le Mans winners among them. I mean, yeah, the whole place is, it actually does look like a museum. It looks like you're going into a very sort of high-end car museum, but they're not museum pieces at all because they're all ready to go. But so we took out, what did we do? Did we take out three cars or four cars maybe? Three cars, I think. And the first one that you drove, and I drove it later on as well, was the Aston Martin DB3S. So the last works DB3S, a very, very significant car in Aston Martin's racing history. I mean, it was the oldest car that I've ever driven. And I've wrote about it for the Intercooler, actually. It's on the app now. The oldest car I'd ever driven, and far and away the most valuable car I've ever driven. Just a sum of money that I can't really wrap my head around. And yet, there it is. Jump in. Let's go. Let's do some driving. And away we go on some local country lanes. Just the most extraordinary experience. And I think what surprised me so much about that car, and it's a sort of late 50s car, but the DB3S was designed sort of early or mid 50s.
Early 50s, yeah.
Early 50s, yeah, is actually how modern it felt. And you said to me, it's basically an MX-5. Slightly glib, but I mean, it had
pattern. Just in terms of the way you operate it, it is.
Yeah, it is. H-pattern manual gearbox.
Yeah, two-seat open sports car. Yeah.
Pedals in the familiar order. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, the way you operate it, it is like a modern MX-5, something like that. And actually, that's not necessarily true of all sort of competition cars of that era. There was another car in that collection with a centre throttle, which we were hoping to drive. We weren't able to because it wouldn't get going, that one. But I suspect...
Despite always talking about all of them being on the button, but I think they thought that had some... this new unleaded petrol with ethanol in it, which had gummed up the carbs or something. But yeah, sorry, go on.
A centre throttle, I suspect if I was taking my time and, you know, driving very sort of cautiously and consciously, I could get my head around it. But it's when you have to do something all of a sudden and, you know, your spine takes over and bypasses your brain and it sends a message to your foot saying, stand on the middle pedal to stop.
Yeah.
I just,
It frightens the life out of me, particularly in a very valuable car.
It's when you don't have time to think.
That stuff really, really blows my mind. I suspect you're much more familiar with that sort of thing than I am.
I am, because you know I've been so blessed to have been to have grown up driving really old cars, and you know I'm no better at it than you would be if you'd done that. It's just something. It's like anything. You just learn how to do it.
It's familiarity,
and then you get in a car. And all I can say is, you know, you obviously need to know it's got a centre throttle. But once you do, you don't think about it again. You just don't think about it. It's like, I'll tell you what it's like. It's like when you get into a left-hand drive car, do you have to think to yourself to use your right hand to change gear?
Well, you do go to open the door once, don't you, when you're not familiar with it?
Yeah,
you do
but
reach
once
for the
you're
door
sitting
handle.
In the car, once you're sitting in the car, every time you change gear, you're not driving along and thinking, oh, damn, there's not a gear lever. And you just don't think about it, do you? You're something in there knows to do it. And it's exactly the same with the centre throttle. You know the car's got a centre throttle because you can see it, just like you can see the steering wheels on the left-hand side of the car. And something on the ring says, okay, fine. So when I want to slow down, the foot goes right, not left. Done. Mm.
Okay, I'll take your word for it then. But this, I mean, the Aston, it didn't have a centre throttle. It's very, very familiar. And, I mean, you had to be patient with the gearbox because it would crunch and grind gears if you sort of hurried it. I wondered if I needed to be rev matching on the way down, if I need to be double declutching or whatever, but actually you just need to be patient, just be steady with it, and it's fine.
The reason for that is that this was obviously an Aston Martin from the David Brown era, so it has a David Brown gearbox in it, and before he bought Aston Martin, David Brown was a tractor manufacturer and made gearboxes as well, and all those cars always had, I mean, the one that succeeded, the DBR1, had a horrible gearbox in it. People sort of used to come out with their hands, they used to say their hands were like a sort of bit of raw steak after they'd been driving that. So it says everything about the car, nothing about you. But it's, you know, you just got to be slow. You just got to take your time, which isn't what your brain wants to do in a racing car. You think it should be bang, bang, bang. But if you do that, it'll just, you know, and also, you know, the only way back then to make a gearbox strong, as they had to be to survive 24 hours, was to, you know, put big bits of metal in it, which, you know, are heavy and take time to move about. So that's why it is like that.
Mm, that'll be why. So I think you said while we were looking at these cars that most of the works Aston drivers in the day actually preferred the DB3S to the DBR1. Is that true?
Yeah, I think the thing about the DB3S, I mean, two things to say about the DB3S. I'll come back. Well, that's the second one. The first thing is, it was for Aston Martin's first successful post-war racing car. They had a thing called the DB3, which was underpowered and overweight. And although the DB3S sounds like a sort of slightly modified version of that, and it was loosely derived from the DB3, the DB3 only ever won one slightly significant race. It won a 9-hour race at Goodwood, which wasn't an international race at all. But the DB3S, which was almost a new car, you know, it came second at Le Mans 3 times. It never quite had the power of the big Ferrari, certainly not the 300 SLR Mercedes, which obviously it came up against in power races or aero races like Le Mans. You know, they weren't going to keep up with the D-types in a straight line because they didn't have the aerodynamic efficiency. But to drive, they just loved them because they just handled beautifully. They were such, to drive those cars the way they need to be driven, to extract a lap time from them, you have to slide them all the time. And, you know, I've driven a few cars of that era, and some of them are really tricky. Some of them, you just sort of think, this thing is just trying to kill me. It just wants to send me off over there at speed. And a DB3S is just, it's like a sort of 60s Alpha. It's just so easy. And you can see, you know, drivers who, you know, obviously mindful of the consequences of losing control of a car at high speed back then, which are rarely pleasant, thinking, well, actually, I can drive this car the way this car needs to be driven, and it gives such margins, and it's so communicative and so predictable that you just feel safe in it. You really would. The only unsafe ones were they made some coupes early on, which are just aerodynamically completely unstable. And at Le Mans in 54, the two coupes both went off, had massive accidents at completely different times on exactly the same corner because they just took off. But other than that, they're beautiful cars. Lovely, lovely thing.
It was amazing to get to drive it. You know, this was a car that Roy Salvadori raced at Le Mans. And just, you just sort of get swept away by the history and how significant it all is. But what really struck me, a couple of things. I mean, one, the gear shift. So you're right, you have to be very slow and steady and patient with it. But it amazes me that these guys were able to do so without actually losing momentum.
They did.
Well, okay, they must have done, but minimizing the momentum loss. To be driving at 10 tenths and still manage to be patient with that gearbox that requires you to be slow and steady, I think that's extraordinarily skillful. But really, the sort of lasting impression I had was just how exposed I felt. I'm just, you know, someone who grew up with modern cars. My first car was a Ford Focus. I'm just, to be in a car that's totally open with only a tiny little aero screen, no belts, I just could never imagine feeling comfortable in something like that, being driven quickly or driving quickly. I just think if I hit something at 30 miles an hour, even at 30 miles an hour, my face is going to hit that steering wheel or the dashboard or something.
Yeah. They didn't have that perspective, did they?
No.
You know, they just thought the reason they didn't wear belts is because they thought if I'm going to hit something, I'm better off out of the car than in it. So, you know, that's it. They didn't have our modern, cosseted, comfortable, you know, safety-first approach to things. They just, that was the fastest racing car that they could get their hands on, so they went and raced it.
So while I was driving the DB3S, you were leading the way in an Alfa Romeo 8C, Tazio Nuvolari's car. I mean, and I was driven in it earlier in the day, and I saw how much skill it took just to operate the thing. You really have to be very, very careful and precise with the gear shift. It's nothing like the Aston one. So just tell us what that thing was like to drive and how significant it felt as well.
Well, to sit there and think, this is the steering wheel, those are the pedals, these are the instruments that Tazio Nuvolari looked at. I mean, the first thing you got to get your head around is the complete, I was about to swear, but just your mind is blown just by the prospect of doing it, and you're in this thing. You know, this is a car that Nuvolari led the 1932 Millimiglia in. He binned it, actually, so reputedly looking at somebody else's accident, which is a very un-Nuvolari like thing to do. But the car is obviously exquisitely beautiful. I mean, staggeringly rare, and with its provenance. And, you know, and its history, must be one of the most valuable pre-war cars in existence. And so once you've kind of realised all that and then calmed down a bit, you've got to drive the thing. And, you know, all those old cars, they're all different to each other. You know, even the ones that are laid out the same. You know, the gearbox is... You know, you have to, because there's no synchromesh, so you have to time everything. So what you have to do is to make sure that the engine is at whatever speed it needs to be at to accept the next gear for the speed that you're doing. So, and that changes according to the gear ratio. So if you have first and second are quite close in terms of their ratio, you probably got quite a quick change, but then you might have a big gap between second and third. Actually, in those cars, usually they have the big gap is between third and fourth because they need to go down the Mulsanne straight. So they put a really high floor. So you can go bang, 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 bang through second and third, and then third to fourth could be bum, 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 while you're just waiting for the revs to fall far enough so that you're in the... And then obviously on the way back down the box, you've got to do exactly the same thing, but in reverse. And instead of waiting for the engine to slow down, you have to speed it up yourself by blipping the throttle. And you've got to blip the throttle to the revs that you're going to need for the gear that you're going into. And it does sound awfully complicated, and it kind of is. But again, it's more complicated than it is hard. Once you understand what you're trying to do, and once you have learnt the gaps between the ratios, it becomes easier to do it. And also the other thing, the great comfort is that people weren't any better changing gear in 1932 than they are today. And so the gearboxes were built to take a lot of punishment because people were, you know, crunching and scraping and doing everything because, you know, they're not easy. I mean, that's what, you know, if it had been easy, then there would have been no need for synchromesh to be invented. And I find with all these things, I'm always much better in these cars when I'm alone, because it's, particularly if there's an owner sitting next to me, you're just thinking, oh, don't screw this up, don't screw this up. And of course, then you tense up. And what you have to do is you just have to relax. And if instead of go, you're just, then it just kind of works. And you have to give yourself time to think. But this thing, oh my goodness, it was so fast. In 1932 car, nearly 90-year-old car, you just get held up by everything. I mean, this car, which, you know, despite, you know, breeze block aerodynamics, would genuinely have done at least. I mean, I think in the first section of the Mille Miglia, 1932, which would have probably been 100, 150 miles or whatever, he averaged over 100 miles an hour. Averaged in this thing. So, you know, just think how fast he must have been. You know, there would have been tight corners in there, and, you know, and the brakes are terrible, and there wouldn't be an awful lot of grip, and yet he still averaged over 100 miles an hour. You know, this is a car which would do, you know, even today, it would do 130 plus, you know, easily, and it's 90 years old. And the only problem with that is that they were actually, even back then, they were quite good at getting engines to deliver a lot of power. I mean, that engine's probably got, I don't know, a supercharged straight eight, you know, it'll be in the 200 somewhere, certainly, maybe a bit more. But they weren't that great. So they're really, really good at acquiring speed. They just weren't very good at getting rid of it again. And these big drum brakes, they just don't offer much retardation. You also obviously got to think about the limitation of the tyres that you're on, which don't have an awful lot of grip. But they also, you know, they get hot quickly and then they go away. So, you know, you're constantly having to manage the brakes. But the other thing, which was just so great about it, was having our mate sat next to me. And instead of saying, oh, you know, could you just keep it to 4,000? Just be a bit careful here. He'd just go. He kept saying, ring it out. So I did. Wow. And so you just get that kind of brief glimpse. And of course you don't, because it's fantasy land. But, you know, you can almost sort of just about kind of convince yourself, not that you're Nuvolari, but that you're having a not entirely unrelated experience to the one that Nuvolari had in the same car. Which, of course, you're not. But nevertheless, you know, you're in the car, you got your foot as far down as it will go. That engine, that straight eight engine, twin cam straight eight Vittoria Jarno engine, is just making the most ridiculous noise. Supercharger howling away, and you're, you know, legging it down the road. Just thinking, what am I doing here? Absolutely ridiculous, but indescribably wonderful. And yeah, I just can't believe we did it. I just cannot believe, because sometimes, you know, because of how I've done my job for a while, you know, I get to drive amazing cars in quite prescribed circumstances, on maybe on racetracks or whatever. But just to, you know, go out this bloke's drive, turn left, and head off into the countryside in Nuvolari's Alpha. It just blew me away.
Yeah,
as you could probably tell.
So I didn't drive the Alpha, but I did ride in it with the owner driving. And there's no question that being in that car, driving it or being driven in it, gives you a newfound appreciation for what those guys were able to do back in the 20s and the 30s. It's the fact that Nuvolari averaged over 100 miles an hour through a section of the Mille Miglia is just, that's just utterly mind-blowing to me. It's as astonishing to me as it is that, you know, present-day Formula One drivers are able to drive 1,000-horsepower Formula One cars with all that aero that they've got flat out. I can't compute either. Neither one makes any sense to me. So, yeah, just to be able to sit in that thing while it was driven briskly.
And the slightly ironic thing is, the more you understand the product, the less you understand how they did what they did in them. Because you just think, you just couldn't do it. You just couldn't do it. You know, even if the car technically were capable of it, you know, you just think, I'd just be too scared. I would spend my entire life thinking, you know, I'm about to die. And you just take, and so because, you know, the instinct of survival is what it is. You just stop. But they didn't. They kept going.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Newfound appreciation for what they did. Honestly, it was really staggering. Okay. And so the other car that we rent out in was quite different. It had a couple of shotguns attached to the out, to the side of it. Outboard shotguns. quite significant car. Can you tell us a bit more about it, please? I rode in the back, so it's a sort of three-seater thing with a very comfortable, almost armchair-like seat in the back. I had a lovely time.
Yes, it was a Rolls-Royce Phantom. I think people will call it, these days call it a Phantom 1, although obviously, like most things that were first, at the time it was only a Phantom. And it belonged to a Maharaja in India when it was new. And the reason for the shotguns, and I'm not going to make a judgment on this, I think we probably all feel similar sorts of ways about this particular activity, but, you know, it was used for going out big game hunting. I should say now that the shotguns have been welded up, they've had their pins removed, so they are entirely ornamental shotguns, but nevertheless. So we'll forget what it was used for, we'll just talk about driving it. This was, I'm not sure what year it was, it would have been early 20s, I think. And if ever you wanted to understand why Rolls-Royces from that era are just known as the best cars in the world, just go out in this, because it was uncanny the way that it rode, the silence and smoothness of it. So, I mean, literally, you come to a stop at a crossroads or whatever, you really can't hear the engine. Big, what is it? Straight six, 7 liter engine. You know, basically, in terms of the gears, which again had to be learned, same sort of thing. But really, your mission is to get into top gear, because once you're in top gear, you can relax, because basically there's nothing it won't go up in top gear. So enormous wheelbase. I made the mistake of saying it was like driving a lorry, which probably wasn't the kind of thing to say. But I only meant it in terms of, you know, when you get to a corner, you can't just turn in, because, you know, you've got to remember where the back is, and you find yourself sort of, you know, driving around the outside of corners as you do if you're in a, you know, a big van or whatever. But just a totally different sort of experience. Not fast. I mean, faster than I thought it was going to be. But just the most amazing thing for wafting along and just feeling the quality of everything. That nothing was done, you know, down to a price. Everything was the best it could be. Such variety in terms of what there was to drive from back there. If I could drive that or Nuvolari's Alphas again, you know, I'd take the red one. But, you know, just as a completely different form of motoring experience. And also, you know, just the pure privilege of being out in something as rare and special as that. It was wonderful.
It was wonderful.
You're lucky really, boys really that memorable. Day, weren't we?
Very much so, and thank you to the owner for inviting us along. So I just want to talk about another car collection that we had a poke around recently, and I'm sorry, the owner won't thank me for calling it a collection for the reasons you explained earlier.
Yes, an accumulation.
An accumulation. So this is a friend of ours, and actually we filmed this collection, and it is on the app in the video and podcast section if you want to go and have a look. It's a friend of ours who's got, I think it's sort of 12 or 13 cars, maybe a couple more than that. And it's rather more modest than the other collection we had a look at, but still very special. And what struck me about it actually is that, you know, the total value of the cars in that lineup probably, you know, adjacent to the value of an Aston Martin Valkyrie, something of that order. And I just wonder which way you would go if it was your money. Would you rather have the Valkyrie, or would you rather have the CLK Black Series, the M3 CSL, the GT3 RS 4-litre, the 996 RS, the 911 no Club Sport, the E30 M3, no the 675 LT, the Carrera GT.
Yeah.
You'd go that
way. It's a point very well made, but of course, I guess the other point is that if you've got a Valkyrie, that's not going to be your only car. It's going to be one of plenty of other things. But no, if that were the situation, I wouldn't, you know... What, one car that you can't really use other than on the most specialist of circumstances, or a load of wonderful cars you can just get into and drive all the time. There's absolutely no contest. None whatever. My only reservation about having, I don't know, a dozen or so cars under one roof, and I know this because, you know, I don't have a dozen cars, but I've got four or five. And even with 4 or 5, you know, the only downside to having those cars is the guilt you feel of not using them as often as you should. And, you know, I had to, I drove my Caterham very briefly this morning because someone needs to put a new throttle cable on it. So I just dropped it off on my way to the train station. And, you know, it was great to get it out and fire it up and take it over there. But I sort of thought to myself, well, you know, we're coming to the end of the summer. When did you last drive it? It's probably been a month. I'm doing a big trip in it next weekend, but I felt bad about it. And I felt bad about going to it and seeing the 2CV there and seeing the Land Rover there and the little Fiat 500 and thinking, well, those guys haven't moved very much recently. And, you know, we live busy lives and, you know, and hopefully, you know, the day will come when, you know, we can afford to relax a bit and maybe the stuff will get used some more. But but no, the answer to your question is there's just no question at all. I mean, you know, but there are probably individual cars in there. I mean, okay, what would you derive more pleasure from having? Something like a Valkyrie or a Project One or a 675 LT? Because if you believe in my mantra, which I always bang on about the amount of enjoyment you get from the car is however much fun it is to drive multiplied by the number of times you get to drive it, then, you know, to me, a 675 LT or a 4-litre RS are, yeah, I'd just enjoy them more. I'd feel I'd worry about them less, but I'd just be in them, you know. On how many occasions that you might drive your 675 LT would you also think about driving your Valkyrie? Well, there'll be track days and that sort of thing, but yeah, you might just want to go on a holiday or go away for the weekend or, you know, take your kid to school or go to a business meeting or anything. Anything at all. And you just can't do that in these other things. So, yeah, to me, no contest.
It's fun to dream, isn't it? And just imagine if you had the means, yes, what kind of collection you'd pull together. Sadly, it is dreamland for me. But I suspect that with a low seven-figure sum, I think I'd like five or six cars, and I'd have real variety in there. And I wouldn't have two cars that did the same job either. So I think I'd have modern-ish supercar. I think I'd have a classic. I think I'd have a daily. I think I'd have a fun hot hatch of some sort. I'd have some sort of 911. Maybe it's an old one. I don't know. But I think that would keep me happy to know that there aren't 12 or 15 cars that I need to think about and try and use regularly, but a smaller number with real spread across the board. I think that would keep me happy.
Yeah, me too. Were we in such a position?
Maybe one day. Good. Okay, well, let's leave that one there. I mean, very special to get to go and have a look around that that remarkable collection of cars and take a few of them out as well. So we'll leave it there. Thank you all for listening. Please remember to rate and review the podcast. It really does help us find new podcast listeners. Please do it. And then go and download the Intercooler app as well and start your 1 month free trial. You'll like it.
As ever, watch the Schumacher documentary.
Watch the Schumacher documentary. Yeah, I mean, that's aimed at me as much as anyone, isn't it? I will go and do that, and I'll report back. And as ever, we'll be back to talk to you again next week.
Look forward to it. Thanks all.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.